Okay, this is the Christianity Podcast brought to you by Jason Shaw. We have an awesome guest today. I'm sitting here with Eric and our guest host, William Long. We call him Bill.
Hello.
Bill is kind of a legend to me right now. I think he's really cool. I was lucky enough to meet him through the Box Seat documentary that I'm still hoping to film. You're an independent filmmaker.
Yes.
This episode's going to be about independent filmmaking.
Oh boy.
So, I'm actually excited about this. Your production company is Dark Long Productions.
Yes.
If anybody wants to go check out the YouTube videos, like the Facebook page, there's some cool stuff on there.
What about Poke the Bear?
Poke the Bear is a company we worked for at one point.
Okay.
Maybe we'll cover that. We'll get into that. How did you get started in independent filmmaking, exactly?
Well, years ago, I was very much into photography and taking pictures, home videos, and things along that line. And I've always been a huge movie fan, so one thing led to another, and I started putting together my own movies and little short films using a VHS camcorder.
Okay, yeah. Those are pretty hard to edit on, I think. I used to have one, but we never edited. We used it for backyard wrestling, so we didn't need to edit very much. We would just record it and then go and throw it in the VCR and watch it. But how did you edit with that? Did you have the equipment for it?
No, it was pretty much you just filmed, cut, filmed again, cut.
Everything in sequence.
Yep.
It's interesting.
Maybe that's why a lot of rookies want to do that.
Yeah.
Okay. Everything's gotten a lot better now with the digital editing software.
Yeah. So, what was the first thing that you ever did as far as film goes, like your first short film?
I believe it was one called When in the Land of Witches that I shot with my family and my kids in the backyard. It was a full-length movie. It's like an hour and 10 minutes or something along that lines. We had a lot of the people from town come help us, our kids' friends and so forth, and we made all of our own props and costumes, and we actually shot it on like 5 different cameras, some tape and some digital. And by that time, we just started using a computer to edit it with, so it was the original Movie Maker program.
And that's the film that you let me borrow, actually, right? Is that the same one, or did you remake it?
Yeah, that was that one and part two. There was two parts to it. We eventually made another one, so.
And how did you get your kids involved in this?
Well, basically, my two sons were in drama in school, and they were interested in theater and movies and plays, and it kind of took off as just a fun thing to do with the kids in the backyard during the summer, and then they got into it, and their friends got into it, and it just pretty much snowballed from there.
Yeah, right on. How has the dynamic changed throughout the years? Do you find it easier to go out and shoot now, or did it come a little easier when you're still struggling with learning how to do things or not having the best equipment? Seems like there's a lot of people interested at the time.
Yeah, at the time there were more people that were interested, and we had less technology and resources, but now we have more technology and resources and less people that are interested, so it's kind of feast or famine for all of it.
Yeah, that's a recurring issue, I think, with just about everybody, is the lack of cast or people willing to come act. It's always been an issue for me, especially when we shot our stuff. The writing eventually became something to the effect of we're writing multiple characters that we're all going to play, and it has to sort of become an in-joke.
Yeah.
That, like, we have
number four.
We have ten characters and four people playing them.
Well, when you watch the movies that you borrowed, it's pretty much the same way with that. There's, I'd say, almost every person in the movie played at no less than two parts. and some played as many as five, so...
Eventually, it became fun to do. And then, at a time, it also became, like, the only type of scripting that I could do, because I was so used, like, to it, that now I'm in a situation where I'm trying to write a bigger movie with a much broader cast, and I keep coming back to some of the old things that I used to have to do in my scripts, because I'm just so used to, well, I'm going to play this character, and then I'm going to play that character, and then Jeremy's going to do these two, and then Jason's going to be the villain, and he's also going to be the chief of the police, so...
And as the director, sometimes it gets hard to take those hats off. I mean, you want to be the editor, you want to be the director, you want to be the actor, because you know what you have in your mind, you know what you envision, you know, as to how it should come out. But then you have to sometimes take a step back, and you have to play that role as the director or the main actor, or, you know, that's why I like working with a lot of different smaller groups, because I get a chance to wear a different hat in each group.
And that's something that I think is really interesting about you, is that you're just totally willing to go help any company, anybody with a project. I mean, that's how we became friends. Mm-hmm. And there's not a lot of people that out there that I think are willing to do that. They want their name on something. They want their product being shown. They want to be the people that you're either watching or hopefully paying to see their
product.
They want
to be the name you remember.
Yeah. And, I mean, I don't get that. That vibe is definitely not a vibe that I get from you. And I think that's very unique in sort of the industry of indie filmmaking.
Yes. My theory has always been that it's a constant learning curve. Everything you do, you learn something new from. So I try to do as many different things as I possibly can. And behind the scenes is usually my forte, you know, editing and building props and things like that. But I do like to get in front of the camera sometimes too.
Yeah, yeah. Are you able to talk about how you ended up becoming an editor? Or,
well, through a unfortunate legal situation with one of the movies I was slated to only be an extra in, the editor dropped out and the position came open, and they asked me if I had done any editing, and I pretty much told them I have like 200 YouTube videos, and, you know, I've worked with editing software, and I've edited my own personal movie, so they gave me the chance and they liked what I did, so now I'm on that. By the end of this year, it'll be like the fifth movie.
And is that all for Wild Boar that you've edited? Five films for them?
This will be the second one for Wild Boar Films. Zombie Beast of the Confederacy. It'll actually be the third movie that I've worked on with them. I've edited three of my own that weren't really distributed. I'll be doing one at the end of this month for the Sins Girls Modeling Group. And I've worked on several other projects with other people, too.
Here we are on this podcast where we're featuring you and we're plugging other people. I think that's just like an extension of your personality that I think is actually really cool. But anyone listening, seriously, if you want to check those guys out, great. But definitely go check out Bill's pages. There's a lot of neat stuff. And you, I don't know if you mentioned it or not, but you do that bikini contest. That's pretty local, too.
Yes. For the last 3 years now, we've been doing the Miss Hog Wild bikini contest in Nanny Glow. And it's a really good competition. I mean, it's a biker-oriented get together, but the bikini contest, you know, they give out decent prizes and stuff for women, and they're usually girls are in college and such, so, you know, it's a good turnout each year.
Okay, yeah. And one thing I definitely wanted to feature is your video junkie thing that you have on YouTube, because you're kind of a wizard with all this equipment that you just build out of basically just random junk.
Right.
And all of the equipment that you use when you're filming, your lights, everything, you just make yourself. And they work spectacularly. I've been on both ends of the equipment, and it's actually kind of shocking. How much? Tell me about maybe your lights or some of the equipment that you build, and a rough estimate of actually how much you spent to make a $500 piece of equipment.
Well, the lights they use for movies are very expensive. I mean, a Canon light or, you know, a Vernell light types, you know, they can get very pricey. But you can build a light that has almost the same level of Kelvin, which the meter they judge, you know, the temperature of light by, and you can do it very cheaply. And the thing is, for me, lights and sound equipment and things of that nature, they only have to work well, not look good. I mean, they're behind the camera, you don't see them in the scene, so as long as they're producing the right amount of light, or, you know, they record the right decibel of sound, then they're worth it. And I feel that the money that you would spend on a $500 light could go to $500 worth of props and makeup. You know, something that is seen on the film that'll make it better. So I, through many YouTube tutorials and a lot of trial and error, just took basic junk and put it together and built my own light systems and sound systems.
How much, other than like your man power and all the labor and whatever, but how much cash did it take to build one of your light systems?
$8.
And this stuff like works, you know, and it's incredible. And you have a story about how there was somebody on a set who was actually kind of judging it, like they called it a pie pan light or something.
Yeah, one of the lights that I made, I actually followed a tutorial on, I think it was Film Riot, and it calls for using a metal pie pan or cake pan to house the electrical so that, you know, no one gets shocked on set or, you know, there's no mishaps. So when they saw this, they remarked that it looked like, I mean, their initial reaction was, is that a pie pan? And I'm like, yeah, but it's also a light, and it, you know, works just as well as light, produces the same amount of light that, you know, a $500 movie light would make. And I made it for under $8. You know, I bought the stuff at a dollar store and a roll of tape, and there you have it.
Do you run into that a lot, or is just okay?
Yes, yeah. A lot of my equipment looks very unorthodox and unusual, but it does the job, and that's what counts.
When you saw his light setup, what did you first think? Did you think, what is this? Or did you, well, I thought, my personal opinion was that this is incredible. I can't believe that I'm seeing this awesome light system made from just random stuff like that.
I actually don't know what I thought. I wasn't like, oh, hey, this isn't professional grade equipment, I can't be involved in this. But then I also was astounded by somebody actually went out and made their own. I didn't have a negative opinion of it.
So, I don't know, maybe if that's like the difference between the people behind the camera and the people in front of a camera. Like, I don't know if it just an actor's mind is just, I don't know, centered on one thing.
They expect everything to be top of the line.
Yeah, one expectation.
Despite their shitty acting, usually.
They're, like, maybe unable to kind of look and see the brilliance. And, I mean, and not just with equipment, but with just about the process of indie filmmaking. Today, we came over, we had no plans to really do anything other than this podcast. And then, just right off the bat, we went out and we shot something because the weather was good and we had the resources and the time. And, like, sort of the chaos of indie filmmaking, I'm drawn to it. And
oh, see, that's the thing. I think we get a unique perspective as indie filmmakers because you are on both sides of the camera. I mean, if you're directing someone and they look at you as the director and they're like, you know, I don't like your attitude, you're an ass, you can look back at them and say, yeah, I know I am, but I know why I'm an ass. You know, I've been on both sides of the camera, and I can see, you know, what you're doing is right or wrong. You know, I'm not prejudging you. I'm not sitting back saying I'm just the director and, you know, therefore that gives me the God-given right to know what's going on. It's not like that with us. I mean, we see all aspects of it. We do the editing, we do the acting, we do the directing. So we have more of a perspective than, you know, someone who's just an actor or, you know, just works on the crew. We do it all.
Yeah. And I don't think a lot of people really appreciate that. And I've told people that I'm an independent filmmaker and they'll like laugh at me and they're like, well, what have you done? Or where can I buy your stuff? And it's like, man, the internet exists and it's a tool. You don't have to go to the video store to watch a movie anymore. And very few people do.
It's true.
I mean, we're not really indie filmmakers, but we're low to no budget indie filmmakers. And I think that in itself separates us. And a lot of people will look down, but then you, the actual creative people, the ones that we're trying to reach out to watch our art and interpret it, dig it.
Yeah.
The first movie I ever did was of Dice and Men. I mean, most people hate it. You rolled your eyes. Yeah, you didn't appreciate
it. Just the mention of it.
But Bill gave me positive feedback, and I like hearing both sides of it. When you tell me that movie was terrible, I kind of chuckle because it was meant to be. But then Bill watches it, and no offense to you, but I mean, he's been in the game a lot longer. Now, you're kind of new to this whole thing, and he's able to watch it and pinpoint some stuff that he thought was good. Then I like to get that feedback too, and I take them both, and I just love the feedback altogether. That movie was made for $6. It was the cost of a watermelon.
I wish you could have got your $6 back.
And everything else was just trial and error, and that was the first thing that we really ever did. We were backyard wrestlers, and we wanted to make a movie.
Well, that's exactly like the first movie that we made. To me, it was kind of, I termed it backyard theater, you know, because at the time I was, you know, I liked the wrestling and everything, and everyone told me about backyard wrestling, so I had watched some of that too. And, you know, backyard theater just seemed to fit because it's pretty much what it was. It was one camera angle and, you know, kids playing a part in the backyard. But when I showed the film to people, I think I was, like, just stunned by the reaction. Because there were, you know, it was half and half. Half the people's like, well, why'd you waste your time? You know, this isn't worth the DVD you put it on. It's stupid. But then I've had people come up to me 5 years later saying, you know, my kids still have that movie you gave them and they watch it all the time. They show all their friends. I'm like, you know, if you get one person that gives you the positive feedback on it, it makes the whole project worth it.
Yeah, that's something I don't think you understand, Eric.
Not about the whole Dyson Men.
But
I've watched your first two episodes of Cop Drama. I thought those were good.
As someone who is now part of Cop Drama, you watched the first two episodes and you enjoyed them. And I don't, maybe it sold you on filming with me.
But not of Dyson Men. If I'd have seen that, I'm going to let Andrew. I don't know what I'm getting myself into, but
oh, I mean, it was ridiculous and over the top, but I'm happy to have the 36 views that it has on YouTube. You know, 7 years later, we don't plug it or anything, but every time I get on there, and I do check it once in a while because that's what we do, whether we admit it or not, we're obsessive over the art, and I'll get on and I'll look at the views, and they haven't changed in 2 years.
Of Dice and Men is the Rebecca Black's Friday of YouTube movies.
And if I had thousands of people tell me that, it would be gratifying. But speaking of YouTube hits, views, whatever, how many thousands of views or likes do you have for your stuff in total?
In total?
Yeah.
That's hard to say right now. I have 4 different channels, and the biggest one, I think, is 23,750 something.
That's huge.
Yeah.
Like, I know people who are struggling to have 2,000, and you get on Facebook and you're like, we're only a couple hundred away from 2,000. Help me out, people. And there, that's a page with 23,000. That's 23,000 more than anything that I've ever done. I think that's spectacular.
Yeah, I would like to see it on the YouTube videos when Randy and I get that started.
Nah, jeez. I don't even want to talk about that craziness.
You're going to be in some of them.
Yeah. As far as acting goes, have you... You feel you've been typecast at all, or...
Oh, definitely. I'm the minion or bad guy number three, or, you know, second thug to get shot. third mercenary to die.
Who hasn't?
So you're like the Sean Bean.
Yeah.
That's not always a bad thing, either.
No, but any character he plays, everyone just assumes he's gonna die, because it's just 90% of his rules.
As a filmmaker, why haven't you written yourself a different role?
I think I have to find a role in someone else's movie first to make me something different before I can portray myself as something different.
To kind of make you believe you can pull it off?
Right. And, you know, you can go on YouTube, you can watch movies, you can study acting till you're blue in the face, but, you know, when it comes down to it, when someone yells action and you're in front of the camera, you never know exactly how you're going to react. I like to think that I'm a good actor, but, you know, I actually have to have that moment to prove it.
That's actually super interesting that you want the opportunity to prove it on somebody else's film before that you're even... It's almost as if you don't want people to think that you're putting yourself in that role because it's your movie.
Right, because as an actor and an editor, I mean, I can pretty much take any scene that I'm in and I can manipulate it and change it around and do whatever I want with it, but it's still my opinion. You know, and I don't want my opinion of my acting, I want other people's opinion of my acting.
I like the way he's going about it. Because, like, right now, Simon Pegg, he worked on the Blood Ice Cream trilogy or some variation of it. But in all three of those movies, he was a main character, and he helped write it. And I liked him better in the Star Trek remake because he was a side character.
And three movies later, he's writing it and pretty much in charge.
Yeah, so he's going back to...
But yeah, because he's earned his way to that.
Yeah.
I don't think I would ever want to be a main character in a movie that I was producing, because I think I judge myself more than most people do, so I'd probably be my own worst director.
So I don't know if I feel 100% the same about myself or if I'm completely like a 180 from that, because at least when I shoot, because I guess I've never had a ton of people who wanted to participate, but when I write, I'm always writing that role for myself because I know out of all of my friends who are going to show up, I'm the one who's going to be able to do that the best. But at the same time, as a director, I don't even want to be in my movies.
Yeah.
I would prefer that I have an actual cast of people and then I can just direct them and work on
the Jon Favreau Iron Man route and just play a supporting character with a relatively large role.
That's what I'm hoping to do with this slasher that I'm writing now. Like, I think it has a lot of potential, and now that we're aiming a little higher than YouTube and going to try to seek out distribution, now that we've seen the other people having pretty, at least moderate to decent levels of success doing it, why not, you know, aim for the moon?
Yeah.
And if you make it, you make it, and if not, at least you did it.
Yeah. But for me in my movies, I kind of take a Stan Lee approach. You know, if it's my movie, I like to do a cameo in it, but other than that...
That's still good. Still, yeah. Something.
Yeah, we did Welcome to Rizal's, and I played, like, I think I was a part of the counter guy at a tattoo shop, which was my job at the time, so it wasn't too much of a stretch.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because it is one of your movies that I have had the time to watch, and I enjoyed it, and as low budget as it is, and I think you were, like, you were pretty much crippled with audio problems, yeah. And you, because of that, had to use a lot of edited in audio and music to cover that up.
Yep.
That's something that I've seen other people just ignore, and I'm guilty of that myself at times. That's a dedication to a craft that I think a lot of people don't appreciate.
Yeah. And like I said, you know, I think one of our benefits at this point in time is that the access to technology is catching up with our imaginations. You know, and it's like, at the time, we imagined how we wanted the movies to look and sound, but didn't have the technology to make it that way. But now the technology has caught up with us, and you can manipulate the sound more and, you know, change the audio tracks. I think we're making better products all the time, so.
And sometimes, like, with technology now, everybody's a photographer now.
Yeah.
Everybody has a camera. Everybody's trying to do weddings, and everybody has their pages on Facebook. But I don't think it's caught up with filmmakers yet, or at least the people who have access to it aren't interested in it. Mm-hmm. I was shocked that I lived 4 blocks away from you, and until just fate kind of brought us together there, I would have never guessed that there was somebody else in Northern Cambria, of all places, doing the same things that I am trying to do. And obviously you're better at it. You've been doing that a lot longer, too. But I thought, you know, bringing Eric along, and we were going to start making trips down to where I'm from just so we can get 2 or 3 other people interested.
Yeah, and that's the thing, too. It's the people are there, and, you know, there's lots of creative people that are out there. It's just most of them are inhibited by like you said, you know, if you tell someone you're an indie filmmaker, they look at you like you're crazy, you know, or, you know, you're just full of it. But there are people out there that are, you know, honestly trying, and they have the time and the patience, and, you know, they're putting the effort into their craft. It's just a matter of finding them. YouTube and Facebook are good ways to do it, but like you said, you know, you can live 4 blocks away from someone and still not know that they're there.
Yeah, I don't think I ever would have found you on social networking. It just happened to be through a person and an idea.
Yep.
And then there we are. It's interesting. Like, Eric, you said you have some friends or ex-friends or people you used to be friends with who were in on the indie filmmaking thing. Whatever happened to them? Like, where are they?
Right now, one's in the Marines. I think they're both actually in the Navy. One's in San Diego, one's in San Francisco, I believe.
And the only reason
that forced them apart.
The only reason I'm bringing that up is because when we decided we were going to start filming, and I had the bug, and I finally, I met you at work.
You had somebody to help motivate
befriended,
you.
Befriended, we became motivated, and we're ready to go, and we're bringing it back. They were also doing the same thing.
Well, for a while it seemed like they were, but I haven't seen anything from them
right.
Since then.
Where are they at? If they have the drive, and if they did it before, and the technology is better than ever, where are they at?
Well,
nowhere. I just want you to say nowhere.
Okay, yeah, nowhere.
They haven't done anything. And that's what separates us.
And they were even popular in Canada for a time. Like, they were on their top 100 YouTube channels.
And to just give that up.
And yeah, that's another huge thing, too. I mean, when you're doing what we do, to have someone in your corner is probably the biggest thing. It's like, I know I went through a divorce and a messy relationship, and I had gotten to the point where I'd, you know, for a little over a year, I just gave up. I wouldn't try anything. I wouldn't even pick up a camera, you know. But then I met someone who was like okay, I don't follow your dream, I don't believe in what you're, you know, the whole, I don't believe that you can go out and make a movie, you know, because, you know, she grew up around here and that's the mindset of people that live here. But she's like, well, you know, I'm going to support you in anything you want to do. And just having that support, I pretty much grabbed it and took off running, you know, and I haven't stopped since. So for the last 3 years, it's been, you know, one project after another. And we had dated for, I think, like 4 months. And she came home from work one day because she knew about the movies I had made before and everything. And she's, I got this article. And I was like, what article? There's a guy in the newspaper making a movie. And he's having a meeting. I was like, ah, well, you know, I used to do that stuff. And she's like, no, you should try this. So she said, I'll go with you to the meeting. And we did. And it's ever since then, nonstop. You know, it's like she'll act in some of the stuff, but she doesn't want to be an actor. But she supports everything I do. And just having that in your life is like the biggest thing. I mean, having someone else in your life that says, hey, I know you can do it. You know, I agree with you, and, you know, you're doing good. That's better than any $1 million camera or, you know, $10 million budget.
Yeah, that actually is really cool. And I feel like I'm teetering on that with my wife. When we first started dating, she knew that I did this sort of thing. But just throughout circumstance in life, I took a 4-year break. You know, I would occasionally write once in a while. But beyond that, I really, until I picked this up again, hadn't filmed since I was in college, 2011-ish. And so at first, me taking all this time, and we have a baby, Blaze, not even a year old yet, she wasn't totally on board. But she, I guess, has seen basically the person that I become when I'm finally able to do this.
And she likes that person.
Yeah, it's better than the guy who's kind of unhappy, not with life, but just because in this life, I also want to do this. And if I could take that family man that I've become and the artist that I've always been, and I can be both of them, it's like the best thing in the world.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of teetering on that now. And, you know, she's been supportive. I'm here now. I'm not getting any text messages. So I don't know, it's been pretty cool. Like, she just let me drop $1,200-$1,300 on an editing computer.
Yeah, so. And the thing is, like, the people that are in your life, your friends, family, relationships, they need proof too, you know, and it's like, I understand that. I mean, they need to see that, you know, this isn't a flash in a pan, that you're not just going to go out, you know, get a camera and shoot a few things and say, hey, I'm a movie maker, and then give up on it the rest of your life. I mean, when they start to see that it's a passion and it's, you know, it's something that you really want to do with your life, then they support you. And when you get that support, it's like, you know, fuel injection. You know, it's time to take off running.
If they're a good person, they'll feel bad for holding you back.
Yeah, that's a take on it too. And I've asked, it's funny, and she doesn't listen to the podcast, so I can tell the story and she won't get mad at me. But I texted my one buddy who used to film with me, and I was asking about his girlfriend, if she would, you know, do some scenes in the movie that I'm trying to do now. And he talked to her, and she's like, yeah, that's awesome, she's down. And my wife happened to, you know, go through my phone, and she read it, and she's like, why aren't you asking me if you want me to be in your movie? And I was like, well, you're not into it.
Yeah, you never displayed an interest before, so I just kind of...
And she kind of got mad that I didn't reach out to her first for that role. And then the next time I brought it up, she's like, no, I have no interest. And I was like, then why did you make a big deal about it?
It's probably there's something there, but she just doesn't want to act on it right now.
And that would be the coolest thing in the world.
Yeah, my girlfriend was like, recently I just had to explain to her that I got the opportunity to do the gig in Ohio with the Sins Girls. And she's like, okay, well, you're going to have to explain to me exactly what a Sins Girl is and what we're going there to record. Because I pretty much rely on her for, like, booking hotels and, you know,
She's kind of your agent.
Yeah, basically. And I was like, well, there are alternative models. And, yeah, some of their pictures are racy. I mean, basically, as alternative models, you're photographing tattoos, piercings, and things like that in various places. And she's like, well, you have to pretty much explain to me what this is. And so I showed her the websites, and I showed her the magazines that they put out. And, you know, once she realized that it was all, you know, a legit business, and, you know, these are real people with real jobs doing, you know.
It wasn't just you guys going out there getting mugged and...
Yeah, and taking pictures of some, you know, scantily clad women for no reason other than just the fun of doing it. But she was, you know, like I said, you know, she's not, it's not like, okay, yeah, I want you to go do this, but she's like, well, if it's important to you and you want to do it and it's an opportunity, then let's do it. So I understand. It's like everything's a negotiation in indie filmmaking. I mean, having time, having opportunity, you know, knowing people, relationships, everything is, you have to work around it. And that's pretty much why it's called indie filmmaking. You know, in Hollywood, everything's scheduled and it's a business. And, you know, you've got $1 million lot and billions of dollars to pay people. But the way we do movies, it's jump out of the car in the cornfield and take the picture and go. So
the chaos of it all, I think, is an attractive thing to me, too.
Like, it's fun.
If I didn't have to steal all of my scenes, I don't know if I'd want to shoot them. Yeah. If I had that money and that schedule and those locations, it would be convenient, but I'd be out of my element. I'm good at jumping out of the car or, you know, doubling back once people realize what you're doing and you get them off your ass, and then you double back and then you reshoot your scene before people show up again. I mean, I've had cops interrupt basically everything I've ever done. Have you ever ran into that?
Several times, yeah.
Do you have any funny stories?
Well, I've gotten a lot of strange looks from people. I've had people walk up to me in the middle of shooting a scene and say, you know, what are you doing here? And a funny story that happened not too long ago is we were shooting a trailer for Zombie of the Confederacy, and we were over in Patton along a dike, and we had the camera set up, and we were shooting a zombie playing a drum. And an old couple, there's a jogging trail that goes along the river, you know, on the top of the dike, and they stopped in the middle of the scene, I mean, between the zombie and the camera, and they looked at all of us, and they're like, what's going on here? They were completely puzzled when my son, who was playing the zombie, turned around in, you know, the Confederate uniform with the drum and just looked at him. They were, that brief moment of silence kind of said it all. I mean, we certainly disturbed a few people that day.
When we did Of Dice and Men, we had a graveyard scene that we had to cut because it was just too dark and we were amateurs and we didn't realize you couldn't take a camera out with no lights into the middle of a graveyard. But it was like a seance type thing, and somebody called and reported that there was like a demonic cult out in the graveyard. And I've told the story millions of times, but cops show up and there's a hill and we were able to outrun them at first, and they all, like, this one actually tripped and fell down the hill, and it was in the middle of winter, so he's rolling around in snow, and he got so pissed off when he finally caught up to us and he couldn't catch us in the act, and we just jumped the fence and jumped onto a porch and acted like it wasn't us. And that's the element, that's the element that I find very attractive about, you know, stealing a location, is we're able to do it. And although the scene was garbage and we couldn't keep it, it was still something about shooting that is way more fun than if I was able to just go into that graveyard at any point, take 12 hours to shoot a scene.
Yeah.
And it's, I don't know. It's just better, I think.
Yeah. I've woken my neighbors up a couple of times and had some strange looks and people complain. The couple of times that people did inform the police officers. We weren't there when they got there, so that was a plus.
That's another thing in this small town. It's hard. There isn't much going on.
Yeah.
So it's, here's that guy making a ruckus again.
People don't like it when there's something going on they don't understand, so. But now my neighbors, fortunately, are desensitized to, you know, if I'm walking through the backyard with a missile in my hand or, you know, building a mannequin that I'm going to catch on fire, then, you know, they totally understand why I'm doing it. They don't necessarily like it, but...
There's no malice in it. There's no malicious intent or anything. And
they know if 10 people get shot in my backyard, nobody was angry at the time.
They hope.
We had a guy who was watching us when we did that head smash, and we broke the watermelon out on the road, and he opened the window when we were done. He was at least kind enough not to interrupt the scene, but afterwards started saying he was going to call the cops and that we better clean it up. And we picked the 2 pieces of watermelon up, and we're like, are you happy? Like, I was going to do that anyway. I'm going to eat this watermelon. Like,
$6 worth of cast.
Yeah, exactly. But it's fun to look back on the projects that we've completed, but I feel like, for me at least, I don't know how it works for you, I have probably five times the amount of projects that never came to fruition.
Oh, yes.
And that's always kind of a disheartening thing.
That's kind of where the video junkie page came in. I wanted to go back and revisit a lot of the things that I had tried in the past and, you know, things that I had learned, and basically as a way to, you know, even though I didn't get to use them or they didn't, you know, end up on YouTube or published, I could always, you know, find a use for them now. So maybe somebody else could, you know, look at it and learn something from it.
Do you have any unfinished projects that maybe you started shooting and then just weren't able to finish ever?
Oh, yeah. Lots of them. From people just backing out of the project and mid-project, and locations that we had that were no longer available, and just, you know, things unfortunately change pretty quick in the indie film business.
Yeah, we have a sequel to Dice, and I always come back to Dice because it was like the first thing we did, and I still like it. And we originally intended to do 6 movies and like come up with a box that looked like a die. And
it's a terrible.
It was
pun.
Brilliant though, because it's a terrible pun. We did this shark abortion where the Dr. Marlowe character's back. He was like half android, and he wants to have a seed to go on and do more evil. So we put a wig on my cousin Mitchell, who was raped in the first movie, and then we raped him again as a joke, just because he hated it so much the first time. And then we had my friend's girlfriend actually play the woman after that. So we just, as a joke, had Mitchell deal with that again. But then she didn't want to have this monster, so we did this pretty dark abortion scene where she's in the basement with the coat hanger, and then I had this shark fetus that I got from North Carolina, and it was preserved. So I took it out, and we had it sort of bloodied it up, and we just shot it perfectly so that when she's done, there's blood dripping, and then this shark fetus comes out with this placenta, and it's just disgusting to talk about, and pretty much only entertains people like me with a dark personality and that humor. But I've always, every time I talk to those guys, they're like, we gotta do something with that shark abortion scene. And it just always comes back.
You can try writing Sharknado 4 for the asylum and have a scene.
There you go.
I don't even want to get in on those people.
Yeah, I think the one that I would like to go back and make better would probably be Welcome to Rizal's. We had a lot of really good ideas that didn't get put into it, and like you said, the sound was atrocious, and I would really like to go back with a more dedicated cast and some more time and, you know, redo it the way it should have been done.
In that movie, you did something really cool, that you took a regular car, you took a KFC magnet, put it on the side of the car, and you had a police thing taped over to that magnet, and suddenly that car, even in that movie, looked 100% official.
Yeah.
And
yeah, and that's the thing. You have to work with what you got. And the art comes into it when you can take a lot of nothing and put it together and make something really legit out of it. So that's what we try to do in all of the movies, but at the time it was hit or miss. You know, 50% of it looked good, 50% of it didn't. I mean, we actually had a professional wrestler that had wrestling training come in and choreograph our fight scenes for us. So we had a really, you know, amusing fight scene, but everything else fell apart. So it's really bringing all the elements together and having them, you know, jive just right to make it work. It's a lot harder than it sounds.
Yeah, definitely is. As far as projects in the future, everybody has dream projects, mm-hmm. and I have two that I always wanted to do. One's Goldfish, and I've done a lot of work for it, like artwork and stuff. And I have probably four versions of a script, but I'm never totally happy with it because it's a movie that I always need. I feel like I need a better cast, mm-hmm. and I can't be the actor in it because the subject matter is so intense. But I also have Gingerbread Zombies from the Planet Neptune is a dream project that I need to do someday before I die. Do you have any dream projects that maybe you can't do, but sometime, maybe in the near future, you have to do?
Well, there's, like I said, I would love to remake Welcome to Rizal's. There's a movie that I'm working on right now with my girlfriend. It's kind of goes against how I feel about casting myself in a movie, but pretty much the entire cast of the movie is going to be me and her. I mean, it's kind of a therapeutic project, I guess you would say. But the dream project of mine would be a script that I wrote called Cannibal Take. And I don't know, it's a lot less special effects, a lot more acting, but I think the issue I would always have is it's got a rather large cast. I mean, 12 characters might not sound much for a Hollywood movie, but for independent filmmakers, finding 12 people that could be dedicated to a project for, you know, up to a month would be, you know, like pulling teeth around here. So
yeah I can vouch for that.
Yeah, it's not easy, but that would be my ultimate dream project to do if, you know, resources became available, and Cannibal Ticks would be number one.
And what's your process? For me, I sit down and I write. I don't put a, maybe I'll think about it when I'm at work. Like, your process of creating what you're going to do. Eric, I know you have this thing where you're kind of obsessive over it, and you'll, like, study everything.
Yeah. It's usually, like, I'll watch something on TV, and then I'll be like, I can probably, you know, work that in there somehow. And from there, it just evolves into its own little arc.
So you're able to watch other stuff, garner your ideas from that, and because you're so obsessive, then you create your own thing.
Yeah.
And
I've been working on these ideas for almost a decade, and it plagues me.
I'm not like that. I'll sit down, I'll think of something, and then I write it. And I used to be able to hammer stuff out. I'm a blocked writer right now. But, yeah, I could sit down and do 180 pages in one night.
I think I'm a little bit of both. Because I'm like Eric, I'll see something like a story on the news or a television show or a movie, and it'll start a subject in my mind of, you know, well, like Cannibal Ticks started from a news report about a new disease. People, you know, couldn't eat meat when they got this disease from a tick or something like that. And I heard this, like, probably 5 or 6 years ago, and then I started writing the story, and I wrote the entire script out. Well, then, like, 3 years later, I heard the story again on the news that where it spread and all this other stuff, and it got me thinking about it again. And the story has absolutely nothing to do with this disease. But at the same time, listening to the anatomy of a tick and, you know, its life cycles and stuff like that got me to thinking and pretty much put it together with, like, you know, 50s sci-fi movie type themes. And like you, you know, I'll get the idea and I'll sit down and write the entire script in a couple of days. But then I'll go back and keep thinking of it and dwelling on it like Eric does and, you know, just keep tweaking and changing it and adding new stuff to it. And eventually I come up with a script that I really like. And 9 out of 10 times I can't do anything with it because, like I said, with Cannibal Tick, it would be the number of actors that I would actually need. And with other ones, it's usually a location I can't find or, you know, something along those lines. But yeah, I'd say my process for building the story is kind of a mix of both.
Yeah, and it's always hard to script for the resources you have because you can't harness creativity. And when you sit down and you're creative and you start writing, you can't even control the fact that there's now an exterior that you can't have.
Yeah.
And you have to go back and, oh, well, how am I going to get this shot now or to do this scene? And sometimes it drives me crazy because I can't turn it off. Like, if I'm at work, somewhere in my head, there's a movie going on.
Yeah.
Or if I'm driving to work and I pass these cornfields, there's a movie going on in my head. Like, I see life through a viewfinder, I think. Would that be true for you as well? Like,
oh, yeah. There are times, well, I'll just be sitting somewhere nice and quiet, and my girlfriend will walk up and they'll be like, you know, where are you this time? I actually, one time I had it really bad. I came up with a story called Iron Moon. And first I started it off as a short film. Then it went to a full script. Then I decided it was going to be a book. And then it was a series of books. And for 6 months I was completely obsessed with this idea till I got to the point where I made myself where I couldn't think of it anymore. I mean, I had so many characters and so many plot lines and so much stuff going on in my head. It was like I couldn't function to do anything else.
It sounds a lot like you.
Yeah, I've got a shit ton of characters. And only a quarter of them are even have one part of their name figured out. So
yeah, and see, my problem was, like you said, about the resources. It's like, okay, we start off as a short film. Where do I get 6 actors? Okay, it's going to be a feature-length film. Where the hell am I going to get a space station? You know, it's like, it's going to be a novel, okay? How am I ever going to get this published? It's going to be a series of novels, and it's twice as bad. So you end up with the story and the thought, but no way to bring it to fruition.
Yeah, and I feel like that's kind of why I'm blocked now, because I had to adjust, like I said, my writing to sitting down, figuring out what I can do as, like, opposed to sitting down and writing the story.
Right.
So now, when I'm sitting down and just trying to write a story, because I have better resources, I have more people involved, I have pretty much everything that I need to tell the story that I want to tell, but in my head, when I sit down, I'm still like, well, he's not really going to show up. He says he will, but I don't think he's going to, so maybe I shouldn't even have that character. Or do I want to spend $100 to rent this place out as a location to shoot one time, and if I need to go back, that's another $100?
Yeah. Well, like what just happened with all three of us when we were shooting, you know, Zombie Beast of the Confederacy. You can plan until you're blue in the face, you know, and it's like, we've got the character list, we've got the prop list, we've got the location, we've got the cameras, we have everything we need, and then at the last second, two people are going to show up and say, oh, well, I have to leave early, you have to shoot my stuff now, and, you know, we're going to change the whole shooting list, and everything gets confused, and things happen. And that's what indie filmmaking is all about, is working around it. It's kind of like the whole premise of the Video Game Nation, you know? It's like, kids today are all about working out the puzzles and stuff like that. Well, that's kind of the same thing we're doing. I mean, we basically were presented with situations on a daily basis that we have to find the resources and find the people and you know, figure out how to work the script and change things to make it work. Yeah, it's like, I know, making a reference to a video game, like with Resident Evil puzzles, you know, it's like you go through a whole lot of crap and you get to the end and there's this weird puzzle you have to figure out. Well, that's pretty much the way it is when you want to shoot anything. It's like you get right to the point where you're ready to push record on the camera and then everything goes to hell and you're starting from square one.
Yeah, well, I think that with Zombie Beast, he handled it in a professional manner, or he tried to the best of his ability. And I wasn't bothered sitting there until 2 o'clock in the afternoon in zombie makeup. But I can see how maybe some other people might have been.
Yeah, and it's like I said, you know, it's the level of dedication that you have to look at as a director or a producer. You know, it's like, do you put more concern on the people who show up at the last second and have, you know, bitches and complaints, or the people who are willing to sit in zombie makeup under a pine tree for 5 hours? You know, it's like, you got to go with the ones that have the heart to do it.
I just wish that place had Wi-Fi.
Yeah, I know.
Well, I mean, I'm the type of director that I probably wouldn't have been as cool as he was to those chicks. I mean, it's pretty well documented that I'm basically turned into Christian Bale.
Our first 5 minutes filming, the very first scene of cop drama, my first 5 minutes ever acting. Eric, you can't do this!
I'm very Kubrick-esque, a control freak.
Well, that's one thing about Troy. Troy is a people person. He, you know, he has more negotiating skills than I'll ever attempt to master, so... You know, and like I said, you know, that's one of the things you have to have to a certain extent. But then again, you also, like you said, you also have to have that ability to change on them and, you know, show them that you have teeth and they're going to listen to what you say or they're not going to be in the movie. So it's walking a really fine line sometimes.
Yeah, and then you're working with people that, I mean, you have a low budget and everyone I've ever worked with is working for free.
Yeah.
And how long are they going to stand there for free while I'm screaming because you messed my line up or something? That's something I've learned over the... I'm a lot cooler now than I was when I was directing Dice, because, I mean, I've always wanted to go back and take the rough footage from Dice and make a documentary about making a crappy independent movie and feature kind of my anger and my drive to succeed at the same time. But we're coming up on an hour. I think we nailed it. Before we go, though, do you have any advice out there? Anyone listening who might now go out and try to shoot, what advice would you have for them? Coming from a person with IMDb credits, this is advice you should take.
Well, my best advice to any independent filmmaker is just do it. Pick up your camera, go out and shoot something, look at it, think about how you can change it and edit it. And don't listen to people who won't pick up the camera. Don't listen to the person who saw you with the camera and says, you can't do that, you're not a filmmaker.
So pretty much, if they can't prove you wrong, ignore them.
Exactly. If they can't say that you can't make a movie, and they can't, because you can, anyone can, then they're full of crap. You know, it's like, just do it. I mean, the best way to learn it, the best way to improve at it, and the only way that you're going to make your vision come to fruition is to pick that camera up and go, and not listen to people who say you can't do it.
You cannot make that werewolf film. You can't.
He will.
Tell your stories. Very much. Nice. When you have art, let it out there. Tell your story.
Andrew, when you're going to talk like this.
And now, after a solid hour, it falls apart.
That just took me by surprise.
Dark Log Productions. Check them out on Facebook, YouTube. Do you have any other pages you want to promote?
Video Junkie.
That's a fun one. I like that one a lot. It's a great concept.
And thanks for having me on your podcast.
That was best podcast we've ever done, hands down.
It's only number 3.
I've been doing them for 10 years, though. Hands down, best thing we've ever done. And we're going to just cut it there, and we'll talk to you guys later.